All right, today we are going to talk about turning water into wine, which is always an interesting story. And I have to tell you from the outset, I don't know hardly anything about wine. The photograph right there is on your screens right now is taken in the area where my niece lives with her husband and six kids. He's an almond farmer. They've got all kinds of vineyards right there in California. I have walked through them. It's really bad hunting in there. There's no critters that live in those vineyards at all. I was hoping, you know, at least to get some rabbit hunting in, but didn't work. But I don't know anything about wine. I know when I was in high school, the drinking age was 18. And Boone's Farm and Mad Dog 2020. Some of you remember those. Yeah, you remember a little too well, probably. Yeah, like most of us do, you know. And it's quite interesting. I didn't think that, you know, Mad Dog existed anymore. I just thought it was gone. And I stopped at a convenience store in where Grand Valley is, Allendale. And I was bringing my daughter some stuff one day. I stopped at this convenience store, and there sat about five varieties of MD 2020 on the shelf, so they obviously still cater to college towns. But that's what it was. And then box wines came about, but none of them ever tasted good to me. And I was in Cancun a few years ago, and, oh, you have to try this wine. It's so good. It's from Chile and all that. And, it still tasted like mouthwash. So I just assumed that if you like wine, more power to you, but it's got to be an acquired taste because I've never had one that I enjoyed. Now, Western Theological Seminary, where I got 2 degrees from there, they have chapel every day, 5 days a week, and on Friday they have communion. And I told some of you this story before, but it was my turn to pick up the communion elements. And I said, well, I don't know anything about wine. And they go, well, go to this liquor store and look for a Christian Brothers label. And I asked him why, and he said, because that's the worst tasting wine there is, and people won't drink too much of it. See, what they do is they pour it into a common cup, and we'd each take a swig of it as we came up. Or the Dutch word for that is slucky. And I went to this liquor store, and I was in a hurry. I saw this handle bottle, you know, sitting on the shelf, and it said Christian Brothers on it, so I grabbed it. Checked out, I thought it was a little ridiculously expensive, but I think everything's ridiculously expensive. And I brought it to the seminary, I filled up the goblet thing with it, and we had to come up and stand in a circle. And they do like 4 or 5 circles, depending on how many people were there. And everybody who's taking a swig of this stuff is going like that. You know, they're just coughing like crazy. And I thought, what in the world is wrong with these people? And then it got to me, and, you know, I didn't like it anyway, so. But the president of the seminary pulled me aside and said, you know, I don't think that's wine. Can I see the bottle? And so I went and got the bottle, and it was Christian Brothers brandy. So, same thing, yeah. It's just a couple of students got into it. It was, you know, 9:45, 9:30 in the morning, and the bottle was drained, and those guys just didn't get anything out of class the rest of the day. But it was kind of a fun thing anyway. I was raised with what I call tight shoe religion, where everything is very rigid and very legalistic. I call it tight shoe religion because we had to have a special outfit just for church. We had our Sunday best. It was a suit. We had to wear shoes. And the shoes were always too small for a growing boy. So they were always tight. And to me, religion became something that you can eliminate just by taking your shoes off. You have freedom. There's so many Sunday rules that we grew up with. It was incredible. We had to pray before every meal and after every meal. And after the meals, there was always a Bible reading too, or a devotional reading of some sort. Every meal, 3 meals a day, we had that. I had to go to catechism, which was not a bad thing, but I always took my faith quite seriously, so I questioned some of the things that I was being taught from the Heidelberg Catechism. I questioned them so much that the pastor, and this was a large church of over 1,000 members, The pastor came out to see my parents to ask what was wrong with me, that I was asking all those questions, and I just was curious. So that all happened. And, of course, there is no drinking allowed. The really pious ones abstain from alcohol altogether and abstain from tobacco, except for they smoked after church on Sundays. And, of course, no sexual activity outside of marriage. Rules that made hypocrites out of everybody. The tight shoe religion was something that always stuck with me. I just couldn't wait for church to be done so I'd get those tight shoes off. And then when I was about 16, the Jesus people came around with their sandals, and I thought, that is Christianity in its purest form. And so I went with them for a while. Now, we don't have the same restrictions anymore. We have different ones. You know, there's fundamentalist groups that, in the name of Jesus, are going around telling you you should never gamble, or you should never partake of legalized marijuana. Of course, homosexuality is a hot button. Race is still a hot button. You know, you say you're woke or DEI, depending on what part of the country you're in a lot of trouble. Tobacco use. If you use tobacco, you are a pariah. It's incredible how they do that. And, of course, there's people that run around with bottles of hand sanitizer telling you to wash your hands all the time. Those are just rules that we add on. But what does it really mean to follow Jesus? Does it mean to follow all these rules? When I first moved to Muskegon, I realized that there were people that still had lots of Sunday rules. And I went to Meijer on a Sunday afternoon. And I kid you not, people that knew who I was, I didn't even know them because I'd only been here a little while, would leave their carts in the aisle and run away. The double whammy was I caught a deacon in the liquor aisle on Sunday afternoon. And also what they did was they looked at me, and I tried to make it look like I hadn't seen them. They stepped away from their cart and disappeared into the store, which I found amusing. And that person is not here today because I conducted their funeral, but a long time ago. But it's just a funny story anyway. Now, religious rules, like I said, are not what they were 50 years ago. But folks still find plenty of ways to feel guilty. And Jesus came to set us free from those restrictions. It's not what you do, what you don't do. It's not what you refrain from. It's what you do. It's not in what you refrain from, but it's in what problems you solve that God is interested in. Now, the Gospel of John, which we're going to be going through, and I'm still quite adamant about making Bible scholars out of all of you, this gospel is very carefully constructed. There's seven miracles in it. Seven signs, John calls them, of who Jesus is. And we're going to cover the first one of those today. Now, the Gospel of John is very easy to authenticate because there were thousands of copies of it made on papyrus, all copied by hand. You know, they didn't have photocopiers or computers or even electricity in those days. So everything, every manuscript was copied by hand. And the oldest one that we have is this one. It's from about 150 AD, and it's just the corner of a papyrus scroll of the first few verses of the Gospel of John. But that is by far the oldest one that we've found so far because papyrus disintegrates with age. But this one's from 150 AD, so it was already almost 60 years from the form of the Gospel of John that we have was put together. So now the seven signs and wonders in there are miracles to prove that Jesus was who he said he was. Today we're going to look at the first of those, where he turned water into wine. Now there's a pastor who likes to draw cartoons, and he illustrates in many of these miracles. And every story in John has a deeper meaning to it. This is how it works. You know, there's a surface story, and then there's a deeper meaning to it. So you have to look at every detail, because every detail in there has something to show us. So here's how this one goes. 3 days later, there was a wedding in the village of Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there. Jesus and his disciples were guests also. Now the question comes up right away, whose wedding was that? Why were they there? And some New Testament scholars think it was the wedding of the editor of this gospel. They think it was John. And because he was related, that would explain why Jesus and his mother was there. And weddings were a big deal. All the weddings took place, get this, after the couple had lived together for a year. You announced your engagement, you moved in together, and then a year later, you got married. And that was the case with Mary and Joseph, too. That's why they were not yet married when Jesus was born. That's just how they did things then. I'm not saying that's right or wrong. That's just how they did things. So on Wednesday night, they'd have the wedding. Big deal, big feast. And then they would lead the couple through the village, taking the long route to their home until they got to their home. What they did was they wore crowns. The bride and the groom had a crown on, and the crown was tied together with the two crowns were tied together with a rope. And that was the custom of the day. Now, the Greek Orthodox Church still does that. They're called the Stephani, which means crown. And they still do that to this day. Now, it's significant that Jesus attended a wedding. With all of the junk throughout the history of Christianity about celibacy and asceticism, here Jesus is saying, no, I go to parties, I celebrate with you. He celebrates that sort of thing, saying to us that God is pleased with human celebrations. So when they started running low on wine at the wedding banquet, Jesus' mother told them they're just about out of wine. Jesus said, is that any of our business, mother? Yours or mine? This isn't my time. Don't push me. She went ahead anyway, telling the servants, whatever he tells you to do, do it. You know, like, hint, hint. It's kind of like those of us guys who've been married a while, when you settle down on your couch and put TV on, your wife says, are you thinking to go to the store? Which means you're going to the store. And that's kind of what it was here with Mary. Why did Mary have authority at that wedding? And that's a question that's troubled New Testament scholars for years, thinking, well, maybe it was one of Jesus' siblings, one of the kids that was born after Jesus that was getting married there. And that's why Mary, as the mother of the bride or groom, would be ordering people around. Otherwise, how could she order the servants around? And there's really no concrete answer. Just that it must have been a familial relationship. Okay, here comes the water pots. 6 stoneware water pots were there, each used by the Jews for ritual washings. Each held 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus ordered the servants, fill the pots with water, and they filled them to the brim. Now see, these pots, 20 to 30 gallons, hence I came up with a number 150 for 6 of them. They were for the ritual washings. The Jews were very strict on that, and they said that this commandment came from God, that you had to wash your hands before you eat, which isn't really a bad idea, but it's not something that God commands. But they had to go very specifically. They had to pour water and let the water run down to their elbows and then cup their hands. And there's a whole thing, and they literally called it the baptism of the hands before they ate. And you were considered barbaric if you didn't do it. Now, this was an added-on part of their religion. And, you know, it's still somewhat practiced today. Some churches have the baptismal font right by the entranceway, and it's filled with some kind of holy water, and you walk in, and you dip your fingers in it, and you cross yourself and curtsy and all that. It's very similar to what they were doing. It's just not Protestant thing. But for them, it was a very sacred ritual before eating. And when I was going through it this week, I remembered working the oats harvest, you know, and with old machinery that got all greasy and all that. And I remember my mom bringing lunch out to the field. That was the farm wife's job in those days. And eating those, you know, peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, or usually peanut butter and ham because they were pork producers, with the filthiest hands possible. You know, there'd be grease on the crust of the bread, but we were so hungry we ate it anyway. And it didn't hardly even hurt us. But that's, you know, it would have been nice to just be able to wash some of that grease off first. So he does this. He fills the pots up with water. And this is the next thing. Now fill your pitchers and take them to the host, he says to the servants. And they did. Again, the authority of Jesus is a question. You know, but they did his bidding. When the host tasted the water that had become wine, he didn't know what had just happened, but the servants, of course, knew. He called out to the bridegroom, "Everybody I know begins with their finest wines, and after the guests have had their fill, brings in the cheap stuff. But you save the best until now." So try to imagine that, folks, 150 gallons of wine. It was a week-long party, but still, that's a lot of wine. You know, and the host makes the point, you know, usually people use the good stuff first, and then when everybody's a little snookered, they'd bring out the Boone's Farm. And that wasn't the case here. You know, usually they wait till a little while. I have a friend in South Dakota, a rancher, who kept cheap beer in a refrigerator in his garage and kept the good stuff in his house, because when salesmen or whatever would come, he'd offer them, you know, whatever, Bush Light or whatever. And he kept his good stuff in the house. Now this would be Jewish wine here, and I don't know if you've ever tasted kosher wines. Now, all wines, by biblical definition, are kosher because they don't have any animal products in them. But kosher wine's a big deal, you know. Like Mogan David has made their name with kosher wines. If you've ever tasted Mogan David, you know it's like toilet water and turpentine cocktail. It's, I don't really care much for it, but that's probably what this was too. But the symbolic action here is what's important. Jesus took an empty ritual and he replaced it with a party. That's what Jesus does. He takes empty, foolish religion and turns it into something joyous. And that was a dangerous thing to do. It ended up costing him his life. No doubt the Pharisees didn't like this very much. You know, they saw it as something being extremely sacrilegious and disrespectful to them. Jesus had just killed a sacred cow. And I'm having the consistory read this book. It says sacred cows make gourmet burgers. And it basically runs along the same theme. You know, studying church history, you study the Reformation with Martin Luther, and turns out there's an incident in the city of Wittenberg where he was for a time. And in that city, most of the people left the Catholic Church and became Protestant. Luther wanted it called the Evangelical Church, but the people just called it the Lutheran Church, which he didn't like. But most of the people were following him rather than the traditional Catholic teaching. And there was one small Catholic group left in the town, and the priest was conducting a funeral. And at the funeral, he had his thing of holy water that, you know, they consecrate the grave with, and they put it over the casket in those days. I don't know if they still do that. But he set that thing down and started reading some other liturgies. And in the meantime, a dog came by and sniffed at that holy water and then lifted his leg and anointed it. And the priest goes, "Huh, even the dogs in this town have become Lutheran." Well, you have to get it, you know. But no doubt what Jesus did really angered the Pharisees, because it was not that much different than what the dog did to them. So the passage goes on. This act of Cana was the first sign Jesus gave, the first glimpse of his glory, and his disciples believed in him. This is the first of seven signs of who Jesus was, and that he brought joy to us. He turns empty rituals into a party. And I think that's the point of this story. I think that's the point of the Gospel of John. He takes down all these He deconstructs all these religious preconceptions that we have and turns us into the real thing. Now, there's all sorts of interpretations of this passage, you know. The Baptists swear that was non-alcoholic wine, but then, you know, how would the host know when the people were drunk on it? I've had experiences with that. I was on a cattle buying trip with five or six guys with my dad one time, and one of the guys was sitting at the table. They all had their big old steaks. This was in Beersford, South Dakota. If you want a real exciting afternoon, Google Beersford, South Dakota. It's got a nice big cattle auction, but that's about it. But anyway, they were sitting there, and this guy kept drinking 7 and 7s. And I was probably 10 years old, so I didn't know what a 7 and 7 was, but he must have had 10 of them because he was really wobbly coming out of there. And I just never forgot that. Well, a few years later, I'm in junior high youth group, and this guy comes in and lectures on the evils of alcohol, and he said he had never had a drink in his life. So this snot-nosed kid in the third row from the front goes like this and said, "Well, what about that cattle buying trip to Beersford?" "Well, that wasn't me." "Okay, whatever." I just never forgot about it. I learned that even youth leaders can be blatant liars. But you guys do realize that just 100 years ago, we were in the middle of the Prohibition, where it was illegal to buy alcohol in the United States. And Catholics and Jews unanimously opposed this. But now, if the Prohibition was going on right now, I would have a license to buy wine because we could use it sacramentally. But this story is not about wine. It's about empty religion being turned to joy. You know, people get this me big, you little syndrome where we like to control people. The government is based on this theory that people can be controlled. Sometimes religion gets into that, which is why I will never tell you how to live. I'll teach the Bible to the best of my ability, but how you apply it is up to you. These people had the burden of washing their hands in a specific way before they ate, or they were considered vile sinners. There's most of the Islamic groups, and some Jews still do this, where they have this ritual hand washing, and some Islamic groups even have it before they can do their prayers. They have to wash their hands and their feet. I think it comes from a twisted joy of making others do their bidding. You know, sometimes control freaks become religious leaders. And what you and I need to know is that this is not how Jesus works. He doesn't work this way. I want to read you one other quick passage where this incident came up from the Gospel of Mark. It says, "One day some Pharisees and teachers of religious law arrived from Jerusalem to see Jesus. They noticed that some of his disciples failed to follow the Jewish ritual of hand washing before eating. The Jews, especially the Pharisees, do not eat until they poured water over their cupped hands, as is required by their ancient traditions. Similarly, they don't eat anything from the market until they immerse their hands in water. This is but one of their many traditions they've clung to, such as their ceremonial washing of cups, pitchers, and kettles." So the Pharisees and teachers of religious law asked him, "Why don't your disciples follow our age-old tradition? They eat without first performing the hand-washing ceremony." And Jesus replied, and this is really strong language for him, "You hypocrites. Isaiah was right when he prophesied about you, for he wrote, 'These people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. Their worship is a farce, for they teach man-made ideas as commands from God.'" That happens all the time. "Then Jesus called to the crowd to come and hear. 'All of you listening,' he said, 'and try to understand. It's not what goes into your body that defiles you. You are defiled by what comes from your heart.'" See, Jesus understood the desire that humans have to control other humans. And he came to set us free. As Paul teaches Galatians 5:1, "So Christ has truly set us free. Now make sure that you stay free and don't get tied up again in slavery to the law." What this means is you can wash your hands before you eat if you want to, but you don't have to. You're not going to go to hell if you don't do it. Okay? It's not a commandment from God. It's your option. And don't make other people do it, unless they're your kids and you do it, you know. But the point is, Jesus sets us free from the mundane rules of religion. He turns burdensome rituals into a party. He made 150 gallons of wine at a wedding in a small village. And he's God, he can do this. So the question is for us is, are we shackled by religious guilt from man-made rules? Jesus is here to get rid of it. He moves us from a covenant of works to a covenant of grace. From a covenant of merit to a covenant of free grace. And the water being turned into wine symbolizes this. See, Jesus defies religious ritual. And that's a major theme of the Gospel of John. When I was a kid, I heard the word sputten every once in a while. Sputten's a good Dutch word. Means sacrilegious, being irreligious, means making fun of the pastor. Anything that they could, you know, put in there like that. And I'm sure that Jesus, when he turned this water into wine, that was sputten. Jesus wants to take your erroneous religious rules and set you free from them. There is no need to carry that guilt around, because you can be saved from it by grace. Jesus is the ultimate chain breaker. But I have to say this with any authority I might have as a pastor, is that if you're not saved by grace, you're not saved. That's the only way in, is to trust Jesus to forgive you. He doesn't care how often you wash your hands before you eat. I'd like to go to the Pharisees and with dirty hands and eat bacon, unkosher food. You know, but the thing is, you're not saved by that. The rules and the guilt are only distractions. He invites us to be set free by Jesus. He wants to set you free, so why not let him? Let's pray together, shall we? Lord, this great gospel of grace always undermines all our religious underpinnings. We want to see ourselves sometimes as quite religious when you've called us to treat others the way we want to be treated. So help us to recognize the religious chains that people would put on us, and help us to accept the fact that by grace you turn the waters of legalism into the wine of freedom. We're thankful for the blessings that you do give us. Amen.